Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be looking at the year-end bestsellers and the sales for the 12 months of the year. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top-selling comics and trades for all of 2017. As you can imagine, that's going to be a lot of data, so of course, I need a lot of co-hosts. So joining me for this year-end episode from the Monthly Mail Report comics episodes and the TV ratings episode is Sam. How you doing tonight, Sam?
Good, how are you, John?
I'm doing all right. But we're also going to be talking about trades. Can't do that without having TJ from the Mayo Report Trades episodes. How you doing tonight, TJ?
Doing well, John.
Cool. And joining us for that retailer perspective and stuff from the Cowcast and Cowabunga Comics is Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Cool. Now, I'm looking forward to this. It's also, frankly, an episode I don't want to say dread doing, but have a lot of anxiety around doing. Because while I do the monthly number crunching and stuff and have gotten at least the comic side down, you know, to a fairly halfway decent system, the yearly one is hard for me to really wrap a strong process around. The nature of, or the format of the data changes from year to year. How many items, what data they release, and it's usually coming right on the heels, if not sometimes before the December numbers. So there's the time crunch and the holidays and whatnot. And the fact that I only do this number crunching once a year, and let me tell you, a lot can change in a year for my system, it doesn't help. Now, add to the fact that last year they didn't release the year-end stuff, so I don't have 2016 to compare it to, and that means it's been 2 years since I ran through this process. As we were talking about just before we started recording, there's a couple of things here and there where the numbers are a little shakier than frankly I'd like, but it's the way it works. And frankly, just the sheer volume of data makes it really challenging for me to kind of fully validate this stuff. So we may see a few things that are a little odd. Now, one of the things that set this year apart from some past ones is Diamond did release an order index value for the top sellers list for the comics and the trades. Now, what that means is I was able to go through the same sort of number crunching I do on a monthly basis and convert that from that index to an estimated number of units. Now, in addition to that, I've got the monthly total reported sales, where I basically say, oh, this is Marvel Legacy number one or whatever. Let's go look for Marvel Legacy on the sales lists for the last 12 months, January through December. Let's see what pops. Now, you would think that's a really simple process, except for the fact that the way that Diamond will list stuff will change over time, certainly over the course of the year, and sometimes they'll do it differently on the December and year-end numbers even. So there are going to be some cases where the total monthly reported sales are what I've got in front of us, obviously not quite right, but I've also got on another tab in this workbook the stuff from the data from the last 12 months, so we can double check stuff if we have questions or whatnot. The other thing that I found very interesting this year is the data came out about a week after the December data, so I'd just gone through that number crunching, cracked that list, figured out what it was and stuff. Got this about a week later, did the same exact process, and there were a couple of numbers that didn't match. And that was for December released data. Now, if December sales are covering what's invoiced from December 1st through 31st, and the year-end stuff is covering January 1st to December 31st, and something was released in December, the 31st is the 31st of December. There shouldn't have been any change. So I think there's some cases of their system is reporting what they've got at the moment and factoring in any additional reorders or returns or things like that. So even things that were, you know, in the last month of the year, there's sometimes a little bit of difference between what was reported on the December numbers and the year-end numbers. So with that, I think we've covered the usual caveats. Obviously, these are sell-in numbers, not sell-through numbers. Trades are still sitting on store shelves. You like having a bookcase full of stuff to sell, don't you, Eric?
Yeah, we actually have, last count, we have 5 bookcases with trades on them.
Awesome. That's one of the things that always surprises me when I get some pushback on the numbers. It's, these aren't sales to end readers. It's like, no, that's not being collected.
it'd be silly if they were, because that would mean stores don't have anything on their shelves. So there is a percentage of items that we do keep on the shelves. However, I will say that from what we get in each month, the percentage of collected editions, whether it be a trade, an omnibus, artist edition, anything like that, the percentage that goes to the shelf on any given week is probably in the 20% to 30% range. So we're not adding a ton to the shelves. It's more of those key things that we know, stuff like you and TJ talk about, Walking Dead, Saga, any of the Marvel and DC staples, especially some of those older things like the Judas Contract, the Abnett and Landing, Guardians of the Galaxy, things like that, where we know they're going to have a long shelf life. Those are the kinds of things that go to the shelf. Otherwise, it's pretty much just straight orders to pull boxes.
That makes sense. That explains some of what I think I've been seeing on the trade side. One question that brings up to me is, you were saying, what, 20 to 30% goes to the bookcase, thereabouts?
Yeah, thereabouts.
So how much of the bookcase that isn't necessarily new that month is kind of coming off? Is it an equivalent 20 to 30%? Or, in other words, is your collection of available trades and stuff shrinking, growing, staying about the same?
We try really hard to keep it roughly the same, but there's different things that can play into factoring on how we do that, essentially. So one of the things on the December trades episode that came out, actually was today, I think, right? This morning?
Yeah, as we record
that
this,
I was
yeah.
listening to. Yeah, so one of the things that you guys are talking about was some really wonky retail ranks for some Marvel books, and DC does that as well. So does Image, Dark Horse. They'll have random sales where they drop the prices on their trades to very low dollars to get them moving and get them out of the warehouse. So we'll take advantage of that. We will stock up for sure. I think when Marvel had their last omnibus sale, I want to say we got 9 or 10 of the 800 count diamond boxes, which are about 18 inches tall, 18 inches, 20 inches wide, and I don't know, 30 inches long. So they're big boxes. We got 9 or 10 of those full of omnibus. So we'll take advantage of those things. But when those types of things happen, we also we'll liquidate products off the shelves. So we'll have a buy one trade, get one free sale, or buy two, get one free. We'll do all sorts of things like that. So we try and keep it so that the shelves are always stocked full. The way that we kind of view things are, if there's a ton of holes, your product's going to look like it's picked over and people maybe kind of like, oh, they probably don't have what I want. So we try and have a nice, well-rounded selection that's always full. There's a couple of times where we'll have a few things in the back room, but for the majority of it, we try and keep all the product out on the floor as much as possible.
That certainly makes sense, because I imagine the square footage of your store stays pretty static from month to month.
It does, and oddly enough, we don't make very many sales in the back room.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right, so what we're going to do here is we're going to start with the comic side. We'll go through that, then we'll get to the trades. It's pretty much a parallel structure for the most part between the two. There's one or two things I can do on the trades I can't do on the comics, and vice versa. But we'll start with the best sellers, the top comics for the year. And this is, again, the top 1,000 items, actually, this time. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less from year to year. But I've got not only the top 1,000, I was able to get another 160 items off some of the other lists, because they do small comics, indie comics, some manga. And I was able to, just with some gaps, get a little bit kind of below the radar there. We've had a couple of years where there have just been some crazy high sellers. This year we had a couple of high sellers, but none that I... let me rephrase. There are only a handful that I think are even close to what could be considered a stratospheric or just a unbelievable smash hit. Now, topping the list is Marvel Legacy number 1 with 105,427 units.
300,000, John.
Sorry, yep, can't read. I need to get my glasses checked. 305,427, thank you. Which is about 519 units more than was originally reported. So again, a little bit of reorder activity below the radar of the monthly list. Over 300,000, obviously a damn strong seller, no argument about that. But we've had some past years where we've had stuff at the 500,000 and even the million-ish mark. So I don't think it's setting any new records there. We only have two other items that were over 200,000. We've got Dark Knight's Metal number 1, and we've got Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man number 1. The Dark Knight's Metal did 278,276 units, whereas Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man number 1 did 233,000. 636 units. And then from there, we drop below the 200,000 mark. The next two items, and we're going to see a lot of event-ish sort of things up here. And I say event-ish because, frankly, the definition of event, I think, is getting a little fuzzy for me. But Secret Empire, no doubt, was a major event for Marvel. We've got issue number 0 at rank number 4 for the year with 172,486 units. And then number 1 with 161,905 units. And then only a couple hundred units below that, we start to see another issue of Dark Knight's Metal. This is the third issue with 161,635 units, followed by number 2 with 160,541 units. We then get Doomsday Clock number 2 with 158,603 units. Dark Knight Metal number 4 with 152,585 units, and then rounding out the top 10 is the first issue of Phoenix Resurrection, The Return of Jean Grey, 145,057 units. So all of these in the top 10 are strong sellers, but I think we've, again, seen some other years where we've had some stronger stuff. We've seen some years where we haven't had some such strong stuff. And everything up here is either a first issue and or part of a major event. Do you guys have any particular thoughts about the stuff here at the top of the list?
Well, I was going to say, I do think it is fair to point out just below the top 10 and in some cases still over 200,000. When you combine lenticular and regular editions, Doomsday Clock number 1 has a total of 261. 248, Batman issue 21's 200,228, Flash 21's 189,000, Batman 22's 186,000, Flash 22's 163,000. So there's a few more kind of up in this range if you combine the two versions.
No, that's an excellent point. Thanks for mentioning that. I'll be honest, these lenticular editions kind of drove me nuts over the course of the year in terms of the number crunching.
Yeah,
I'll admit, as a reader, I passed on all of them because I figured if I can get the story for a buck cheaper and whatnot, I will. But I get the coolness of them. But it does make the numbers look a little weird in terms of you've got things that are actually selling better but lower on the list because you've got to add two of the items. And also, when you take something like a Doomsday Clock number 1 that has the lenticular cover, compare it to a number 2 that doesn't, it looks kind of wonky. And I can't really add the lenticular sales in with the regular sales, even if I might want to. And I'm not sure that I would want to, but I might. Because the way Diamond has them, well, they're at a different price point. As such, Diamond has them as different items on the list, which makes sense to me. In addition to the cover being a definite sales factor, I think the price is too. Mixing things at different price points is just, it would make it really hard and challenging to accurately calculate on a month-to-month basis the retail ranking or things of that sort.
But I think to be fair to that comment, and Eric, I'd love to hear your opinion in here. The ones that have the same cover price, but let's say are 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 200 and do get combined, let's face it, those don't really have that cover price because they're not available at that price anywheres.
Right. Correct.
That's an interesting one because I see both sides to that. I mean, they're not for sale at that cover price, certainly a 1 in 1,000, no way. But it's I don't want to say it's gaming the system.
Even the 1 in 25s are rarely available at cover price, and only months later.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that's... So when we look at taking advantage of something like a 1 in 1,000 or even a 1 in 500, for us, the only way that it becomes feasible is that those variants pay for your overage in what you're ordering. Otherwise, you're losing money, so there's no point to it, which makes us be very selective about it. And it does, there's certain things that Marvel in particular will do that kind of, I don't want to say they hyperinflate the units because the units are the units, right? That's what's invoiced. What I think gets hyperinflated is the cost or the value of all of that. So I just did a couple quick looks, and for Peter Parker, which is number 3, and Marvel Legacy, which is number 1, I just ran some quick numbers on those. I could go through the list and it'd take me a while, but I could put it all out there. Those books obviously were big number one launches, right? Marvel Legacy was kind of supposed to reset the tone for the Marvel Universe, and Peter Parker, number one, kind of coming back. So there's a couple of big things there. Marvel Legacy had a 1 in 1,000. I think it had 1 in 500, and it had some lower tiered unlocking variants, as well as, like, I think, like a 1 in 50 and a 1 in 25. Peter Parker, I think, capped out at a 1 in 500. We went all in on Marvel Legacy, did 1,000, got the 1 in 1,000 and all the variants, sold it all ahead of, sold a variant set and had quite a few variants to spare. And through the sale of the variant set and a couple other things, we had money back already before the product was in the door through pre-sales online.
Nice.
So that was a huge one for us. Peter Parker, we didn't play with that one. We didn't go 500. We didn't get that because it wasn't one that we felt we could move. Now, the reason I say that is there's a couple of different things that Marvel does as well to incentivize retailers on top of just variants. For Peter Parker, if a retailer had increased their order 175% over what they ordered for Amazing Spider-Man number 23, you would get up to, depending on who you were, but you get up to an additional 15% off. So each retailer has a different discount tier that they fit into, and that's based on rolling sales. And I know, John, you've kind of described that before. Mm-hmm. But basically, if you hit 175% over your ASM 23 order, you would get an extra 15% off. And I think it was if you hit 150%, you got an extra 10%. And if you hit 125%, you got an extra 5% off. So that's one thing that they do that will sometimes make it profitable. And then what they ended up doing with Marvel Legacy, because they wanted as much of this in stores as absolutely possible, was that, so that is it's a $6 book, right? $5.99. What they ended up doing for that one was if you increased your order 250% over Secret Empire 2, the book was a 75% off net cost. So that's a massive savings for a retailer. But the only time you're going to hit that is if you're jumping up to a really high number. So that was a case where it made absolute sense for us to go for that 1 in 1,000, collect the variants along the way. We're paying a lower net price on everything, and we can recoup it quicker. So there's a number of other Marvel books in here that have similar type things. That net cost one was a special thing to Marvel Legacy this year. We didn't see that with any of the other books. But things like Venom 150, that had a 1 in 1,000. Phoenix Resurrection, that had a 1 in 1,000. Both of those we did. I think there's a couple of other Marvel ones that had at least 1 in 500s, which we didn't do, but they're there. Amazing Spider-Man 25, that was a 1 in 1,000 that we did. So there's a few that we go for, and then there's a number that we don't. But what you'll end up seeing is a lot of the ones that filter to the top have those higher variant tiers, and usually Marvel will incentivize the retailer beyond just getting these special unlocked books by also getting a higher discount, which some people may get a little upset to hear that we're paying less than what we normally would to get a book. However, that's fine. You can be a little frustrated with it, but we're the ones putting our neck on the line, and we're the ones that have to try and recoup it. So for us, that's just how we make money and try and keep our business profitable as much as possible.
When I was a kid, I worked at a store out in the San Diego suburbs and such, and I would help sometimes the store owner do the order. And by help, I mean I'd be the guy he'd send over to the rack. It's like, how many issues of Wonder Woman do we have left? How about Batman or Alpha Flight or, you know, whatever. But it was educational for me because he'd be sitting there behind the counter with a solar-powered calculator. He'd just kind of running the numbers of, okay, I did this many units of that. This is how I think it'll do. Let's multiply it out. Let's see how it goes. At that point, you could do the order literally with a pencil and a handheld calculator. But every time I look at the retailer incentive things, like you were just talking about, the 1 in 500s, the 1 in 1,000, even the 1 in 10s, or the 1 in 25s, or the order X percent over and above, or as much as or more than this other comic you did 3 months ago, or 2 months ago, or whatever. It seems to me like you've got to have a spreadsheet and a significant amount of time to kind of really take advantage of those things properly.
Yes, there's always calculations about it. Thankfully or unfortunately, Marvel is usually the only publisher that we have to worry about doing that with. But no, it definitely takes more time because there's certain factors you have to figure in. For us, we won't start doing the math until we know what's going on with the actual books. So in the case of Venom 150, Eddie Brock is coming back. Okay, well, that's a no-brainer for us because we know that Eddie Brock is going to sell well. We know Venom sells well. We know that ASM, well, I guess Spider-Man in general, is coming back to the forefront of discussion because of the adjustments in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So there's a lot going for it there where we knew that there would be enough momentum that, assuming we sold through the variants, which I think I said there was a 1 in 1,000. I think it was only a 1 in 500, which we did the 500 on. But either way, we knew that there was enough momentum that we didn't have any problem with doing it, going in for that and selling through, at least to make some money and then have enough product left over. The other one that we did that was a no-brainer for us was the Phoenix Resurrection Jean Grey number one. And originally when it was solicited, the 1 in 1,000, you could only, I think it was just the A cover counted towards that. And James sent an email to one of our friends at Marvel, and he responded saying, if you want to order 1,000 of the Archerm cover, then you can use that to unlock the 1 in 1,000, which then went retailer-wide. Everybody was given that opportunity, and then they created the Archerm Virgin variant. But that one, we knew if we could get 1,000 Archerm variants, we knew that we could sell those for years to come at out of the shop and in shows because of the caliber of artwork that Archerm does. Things like his Batgirl covers, his Supergirl covers, they always sell tremendously well for us. The Batgirl covers sell for 4 to 5 times cover in some instances. So it was one of those things where that's a calculated investment that we knew we would at least break even by selling the variants that came with it. Plus our off-the-shelf sales were going to be higher because we have the folks that collect Archerm covers and taking them to shows. We knew that we'd be able to sell them at cover price with no problem. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, and we have to take into account what those things are before we even bother to do the math.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, you've got to have the context of how it's doing. But even then, I think it's still more risky than it may be beneficial in general. Obviously, there are times if you know what you're doing, and clearly you do, you can do well. But man, it would drive me nuts if I were a retailer having to do this. My hat is off to you.
Most fun time, but it's worked out well for us.
And I want to just point out something you said. You said with that legacy issue, which happens to top the list here, that if you increased by, 250%, you got a net cost of $150, which was basically a 75% discount. For argument's sake, and I realize it varies a little store to store, standard discount, call it 50%, is your, average, discount.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you increase your order by 25%, it was buy one, get one free.
Right.
Which, again, if you're trying to look at this list as how well a book does, you could argue the top item on the list is essentially inflated by twice because they sent out that many free copies.
Right, exactly. So that's I think, to John's disclaimer on these episodes. Right now, we have an inordinate amount of dust that needs collecting in the back room, and Marvel Legacy is helping us collect that dust.
Well, and I mean, the whole point of the game in some people's mind is to sell as many of these comics to retailers as possible, and if they're collecting dust or if they're getting into readers' hands, it doesn't matter to some degree to some of the publishers, I think.
But at that point, you're not even selling, John. Well, you're literally giving them away to make this number look good.
That's a fair interpretation. I think they would counter with, but we have sold them and we can report it as sold. And I'm not saying either side is 100% right or even the least bit wrong, necessarily. It's a semantics thing. But I give a lot of credence to the we've given half of them away. Does that really count? Out of the 1,160 items I've got, the top 1,000 plus 160 below it, 1,026 of them have multiple covers. That means out of all of this, only 134 didn't have a reported multiple cover. Now, I don't have all of the interim stuff between previews and stuff like that. So some of these may have had a second print or some other variant cover that came later. But if we look at the top of the list, and really we could go almost down the entire list, we're going to see that a lot of these have some sort of gimmick or variant cover or incentive or heavy promotion of some sort or another that got these sales to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue it's not even necessarily true, because of the ones that you have not marked as having multiple covers, the lenticular 2 version ones are in that list.
That's a fair point. I have them as a single, so that cuts the 134 down.
Exactly.
By at least a dozen, because that doesn't count. We'd have to take out of that the 4 issues of The Button between the 2 of Batman and the 2 of Flash, the 5 issues of the Oz Effect, at least 1 issue of the first issue of Doomsday Clock, and I'm trying to remember if they did lenticulars on other stuff.
And then you'd have to double that number because you'd have to take out both versions.
Yeah. So most of this list is something that has been... trying to think what's the right way to phrase this, because it's they're driving the behavior of getting retailers to order more stuff, to either put them on the shelves, put them in the back room, whatever. But from a publisher point of view, that counts as a sale, whereas I think from a reader hobbyist point of view, we're all looking at it like, I don't know.
Well, I think there's a big difference too between reported sales and sell through. Right, so we talked with Marvel Legacy how we have a number of them in the back collecting dust, or shall we say, they're marinating for another time.
Reserved for future collectors.
One. Right, there you go. It's like a fine wine. It's curing.
Yeah.
The next one, Dark Knight's Metal. So that one had a 278,000 unit sale, and there were variant covers, but there were no unlocking tiers. There were no multiple price points on it. And that's a book that we had near total sell-through on. I think we have 2 copies left on the shelf of Metal number 1. And I think by and large, I'm not going to say all, because you can't say all, but I think in most stores, that was the case. Metal was a great seller, continues to be a great seller. Yes, you're going to see that waning over time. You're going to lose a few people here and there, but the sell-through level in our store for the DC Comics was a higher percentage because we didn't have to jump to hit certain unlocking tiers, so we could go to a more natural number. So in the case of Dark Knight's Metal, say we would normally sell, I don't know, 40 issues of Batman. We look at Dark Knight's Metal and say, okay, this is going to be a bat-centric book. Let's maybe double the orders on that. We sell through 75 out of 80 copies. That's awesome. That's a huge, huge, huge win. We didn't have to play any games. We didn't unlock anything. It just was what it was. So I think what you'll see on this list, the only one with exception for us would be Doomsday Clock number 1, because there were the lenticular covers and then the other covers, which we have sold through most of. And in fact, we've actually had to do some trading with a couple of shops in the area who ran out, who had some books that we either got damaged or didn't get enough of. So we've traded with them some of our Doomsday Clock to where we're getting pretty thin on some of the issue 1 and 2. But by and large, we have seen in our store a higher sell-through percentage with DC. But that doesn't necessarily mean we've had a higher percentage of our net income from DC. Marvel variants carry a lot of weight, even though we have extra Marvel stock in the back.
Yeah, that actually is an interesting point in that from the complete, from the perspective of what me and John talk about what's good for the hobby, it seems like you just kind of spoke for a few seconds about how DC, in a lot of people's minds, that's the right way to do it, quote unquote. But what actually makes you more profit is because you are very efficient at using Marvel's system. Marvel makes you more money. So it's an interesting perspective, where sometimes we think that what Marvel does is damaging in the long term. But if you can figure it out and can efficiently use it, it seems like a very profitable enterprise for the retailers.
Yep, agreed.
What I find interesting is Joe Quesada the last week or so has been particularly vocal about the amount of waste created in the newsstand days and how much more efficient the market is now without having, essentially to mulch books. But what you're saying, as a retailer, you end up having to mulch a bunch of Marvel books simply because you ordered them to get the few that you could sell.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we will keep the extra stock and we'll pull it out for shows. The other things that we do is, like for Marvel Legacy, we were kicking around the idea of pulling out 100 copies of it and putting those out for free comic book day. And just saying the first 100 people in can have a Marvel Legacy number 1 if they want for free comic book day. I'm not sure if we're going to do that, but it was an idea we kicked around. So it does give us some flexibility of other things that we can do. But yes, absolutely. Marvel does create extra stuff that we have to store based on how they sell the product, and for us to make the most money, how we buy the product. I'm not going to say, though, that it's all bad, especially in the case of like a Marvel Legacy number 1. that is a book that theoretically should have some lasting impact for a while. So it's something that people will continue to come back for, whether or not they're going to come back this year, next year, 5 years from now, depending on what Marvel does, we don't know. But, you know, it's not like it was a total waste in some regards.
I agree with that. But I do think it's funny that for one of their top people to be so vocal about how many issues were printed and virtually wasted in the newsstand days, he's found a new model to essentially do the same thing and say, yeah, but I'm much more efficient than they were.
Well, it's efficient because he doesn't have to take them back.
but he didn't have to take back the covers either. He just counted them and the distributors took them and then threw them out, you know.
When I've done some analysis on the statement of ownership data that used to be in comics, what I found was typically for every 5 copies printed, 1 was sold. So there was about an 80% waste. It was pretty significant. And I think for some comics that are not going nuts on the variant covers and stuff, this is a much more efficient system now. But then you toss in a couple of those things where they've got the 1 in 1,000, the 1 in 500, or 1 in 2,000, or whatever crazy stuff. And then I would really love to know how many of those actually sold versus dust collectors or whatever you want to call them, because that does seem way more wasteful on just like an order or two of magnitude compared to the old days. This is where having sell through information, I mean, I would love to collect that or analyze that. Because I think that would answer a lot of our questions around this of, you know, out of these 300,000+ units of Marvel Legacy, what percentage of them actually left the store as a paid purchase?
Yeah, absolutely. It would be incredibly difficult to get that because of the amount of different platforms that people use for it. And in our case, like I said, you know, we have a good working relationship with a couple of stores within, you know, a half hour of us. That if needed, we will trade product with them and kind of treat it as a credit system. So we give them 10 of one book and we, you know, whatever our discount is, that's how much credit we have with their stuff. And we just kind of do it on the honor system. So you got to accounting for that's a little tricky at times, but it would be interesting to see from where I sit and from the conversations that I'm seeing on some different locked Facebook groups. There definitely seems to be a consensus that the sell-through level on DC for the, now I think last I heard there was about 3,500 diamond accounts. That doesn't mean there's 3,500 brick and mortar stores. I think they're estimating just under 3,000 brick and mortar stores, or right around 3,000. Okay. And the rest are con sales, or there are a few people that run subscription pull lists from essentially from their home, but they have it kind of tagged as like a brick and mortar shop, even though they don't really have open hours. But regardless of all that, so there's about 3,500 accounts, and I think of the 3,500 accounts, there's about 800 people. Granted, there could be multiple people per account in some of these closed groups. So from that small subset, say it's 500 out of 3,500, those people are vocally saying, by and large, that DC has a better sell-through rate for them. So I don't know if that's statistically significant or not, but from the people we talk to, that's what we tend to hear as well in our areas, that DC has better sell-through, but Marvel does have more levers you can pull as a retailer.
And it comes down to, what do you see as a sign of success, sell-through or profit?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a quick little aside for Eric, it's kind of like a two-part question. One, you said that for the 1 in 1,000 and the 1 in 1,500, one of the ways that you really take advantage of that is the availability to pre-sell it online. Now, I'm assuming that if you could only sell to people that were basically within 50 miles of your shop, you'd be much less willing to take that risk because it'd be a much risky proposition. And then also, second part of the question is, when someone's buying a 1 in 1,000 variant, I can't expect that to be very inexpensive. Do you have to ship it to them by certified mail with insurance, or how does that work if they're in a different state?
Sure. So the first part, yeah, if we didn't have essentially a worldwide market, it would adjust how we look at things. We are lucky that we're close to C2E2, Chicago Wizard World. So we have a couple of big shows within like an hour and a half drive from our store. So that does still give us the opportunity to get some of those bigger books and have a venue to sell them if we were to set up there. But it does change how it would change how we would look at ordering things. And as far as when we do sell some of those variants, we do. So we have kind of a standard protocol and we provide a base level of insurance. And then if the buyer wants to add on insurance, it's essentially at their cost. And the cost of the books, like you'll look on DCBS sometimes and they'll have, you know, one in 1,000 will be $2,900 or something like mm-hmm. that. And for us, we may be able to sell it for $2,250.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, essentially a $650 savings there. And usually people will opt to take part of that savings and put it towards covering the cost of insurance up to a certain amount to make it worthwhile. So it's really, we'll do a little bit of coverage, but then it's on the buyer after that. We do also have people that will buy them and then drive to us to get them. So
yeah,
that
makes a
difference.
And that would make sense with that price. And then a follow-up question that you don't have to answer if you want. Have you ever had one gone missing in the mail?
We've never had one gone missing in the mail. What we have had happen, though, with the ASM 25, it was, I want to say it was a $6 book, and it was either double or triple size, super thick. And what ended up happening is through shipping from Diamond, because of the thickness of the book, the cover started to tear at the top and the bottom of the spine. Oh. And that was a book that we had pre-sold for a lot of money. It was an Alex Ross cover, which was essentially why we said, yeah, we'll do that. So what we ended up having to do is contact Marvel, essentially. Diamond was not, they were sympathetic, but they didn't really take much action on it. So we had to talk to Marvel, and you can actually go to YouTube and find videos, not of us, but of other people that had the same issue. We ended up having to have three of them shipped to us before we got one that was in passable condition that we could, in good faith, send to the buyer. And so we had to rip the cover off of essentially ended up being close to a $3,000 to $4,000 book, which was not easy to do two times, but we did.
That was either going to be nerve wracking or very enjoyable, depending. I don't know.
Very nerve wracking. And you can actually go to YouTube, and there was a shop. I don't know if it was in California. I think it was in California, but theirs had the same issue, and they took the staples out and they ran theirs through a paper shredder. So,
wow.
Yep. So that's what that has happened to us. And that, I'm not going to, you can't blame Diamond. Some of the things Diamond does, you can blame them and say, really, you didn't think about that. But by and large, a lot of the damages that happen are just due to the amount of times things have to get touched.
Yeah,
that makes sense. We go a little ways down the list to rank 82. It's our first non-Marvel and DC book, I believe, unless I missed one. It's Walking Dead 164, 86,918 units. And you could get into the top 100 if you sold around, 75,000 units or something this year. Just to put that number into perspective, I think it was January 2011 where nothing sold 75,000 or more. If I recall correctly, there was one month where it was just a really low top of the list for the comics that month. One of the things I'm noticing as we're looking at, say, the top really 65-ish or whatever, there's a lot of DC stuff. A lot of it being Batman, or actually most of it being Batman. But some other stuff, you know, Dark Knight or the Dark Knight Metal stuff, things of that sort. I think we're at a point where DC is stronger this year than it's been in many other years. But there's also some points, you know, below that kind of 65 down into the 100 range or whatever. There's also a lot of Marvels there, too. So, was there anything else that jumped out at you guys as of particular interest in the top 1,000 items or whatever for the year?
Well, I'd like to comment on that, what you just said, with a lot of above the 65 threshold, a lot of DC specifically, a lot of Batman. What we experience with DC in general tends to be that we have a lot better consistency. And on an episode of our podcast, James and I talked about how that allows a publisher to plan better because they can kind of start to get a real good feel for what kind of numbers they're going to do. And it's the same with a retailer. So one of the things that both comics and trades, what I think a lot of retailers have started to do, and it probably started after the 2009 economic kind of bubble burst a little bit and continues more so today even, is that most retailers don't have the foot traffic of, say, a Midtown Comics, where you have a million people a day, you know, walking within 50 feet of your store. So we don't have that kind of foot traffic. And what we have to do is we have to make sure that whatever we order either sells through or it's going to sell through quickly. And what a lot of people have talked about in the retailer side of things is that with DC, I'm never going to say it's easy, but it's a lot more predictable to figure out what your numbers are going to be. And that's why we see a lot of the numbers staying pretty close. Like you'll see, and same thing with Walking Dead. The times you'll have a fluctuation with Walking Dead is if a new character is being introduced or if there's a variant cover for something, because usually they're after their Whisper War, there wasn't really a variant cover until the, I think the latest Sienkiewicz covers came out. But you'll see like the higher those numbers and issues go, generally you'll see a lot more grouping and clustering because it's so much easier for us to say, oh, we had one person add it to their pull list or we had two people drop it from their pull list. We're going up and down an order of magnitude that's very small, you know, 5% or less. Whereas with some of the Marvel titles, it's like, well, it's a new number one. We'll put 10 on the shelf and, oh, okay, I guess we're only going to get two next month kind of thing. So it's you see a lot of that reflected in the numbers where there's not as much of a wild fluctuation.
Well, one of the things I've noticed from month to month is not only do the DC titles tend to be more consistent, like you were saying, in terms of the sales numbers, but also in terms of the release schedule. You know, over the last year or two, I've been tracking, you know, titles that drop off the list one month because they just don't ship and pop back up another time. You know, and the number of titles that get suspended and return like that for DC is really few. And there'll be a couple of things because if something goes, you know, like bi-monthly, like the Mystic U, or ships a little late here or there, like Dark Knight Metal or whatever. But again, it's a handful of items. Whereas over at Marvel, they've had a couple of titles that were just getting kind of chronically late in a few cases, or at least egregiously late, if not chronically late, like Silver Surfer or whatever. But also, the number of titles that'll do, okay, two issues this month, one next month, three the next month, or whatever, just would bounce around a lot. And that may just be a matter of DC is very much either it's monthly or it's twice monthly, and for a fifth week we'll do annuals or something. Whereas Marvel seems to be doing, in some cases, they were doing it in years past at least, like 18 issues a year, which means you've got, you know, one every 3 weeks or something. So 1 month you'll have one month you'll have two, then one, then two, you know, that sort of thing. So it does seem like it'd be harder to kind of project what your earnings or cost or whatever would be with Marvel versus DC because of both the scheduling flux and inconsistencies, if you will, from month to month versus DC, which seems to be a lot more clockwork-like.
Yeah, yep, exactly. I did do one other thing. I went through and looked at what our top sellers were for the year.
How does it line up with this?
Share that?
Yeah, how does that line up with this? I'm curious.
Yeah, so I'm not going to tell you numbers. I'm just going to tell you in order what our highest sellers were. So number one, Marvel Legacy.
Okay.
Number two, Doomsday Clock number one.
Oh, did you count both the lenticular and non-lenticular?
I did, yeah. I added all of them together.
Okay.
Number three, Amazing Spider-Man 25, which again was one that we did a 1 in 1,000 and carried all the variants.
Got it.
Number four, proud to say, was the Cowabunga Comics variant of Jimmy's Bastards number four. That one obviously is not on your list. Number five, Dark Knight's Metal number one. Six, Secret Empire number one. Number seven was Dark Days, the casting number one. Eight is Doomsday Clock number two. And number nine was Batman 24, which was the proposal issue that had four covers, or mm-hmm. four printings, five covers. And the number 10 was Flash 21, which was part of the button.
All right. So all of that and was, for the most part, stuff on the list.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I keep going down to like 25, you're going to see a very repeating trend, which is DC, 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 Marvel, DC, Image, Walking Dead, and then DC, 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 Marvel, DC, DC, DC. So,
historically, do you think your customers lean more towards DC, or is it just that that's what they're happier with now?
Historically, our customers tended to be more Marvel.
Okay.
But the tides have shifted a little bit. We're seeing more DC, and for a couple of reasons. We're seeing people that are saying, you know, X-Men Blue, X-Men Gold, and now X-Men Red. That's just too much. I don't even want to keep track of that. Or six different variations of Deadpool. I'll take one Deadpool. But we're not seeing that kind of burnout with Batman, which is really interesting. So we have people that are getting Batman, the core title. They're getting Batman White Knight. They're getting Kurt Busiek's Batman title. They're getting the Dark Knight stuff. And there's just not that saturation burnout. And I don't know if it's because we haven't had as much, as long of a timeline of saturation as we have with some of the Marvel properties, but it's kind of unique. And James and I talk about that every once in a while, like, you know, people keep buying it and people keep wanting it. We're going to keep getting it. So that's a really interesting thing for us.
It's interesting because with those Batman titles, I could probably explain how they're delineated differently much better than I could do a delineation of the various X color books.
Granted, yes.
All right.
Well, and here's the thing. You mentioned you feel we haven't been as saturated with Batman. Here's the thing. I've been a Batman fan my entire life. There have basically been 4 to 8 Batman books every month for as long as I've been alive. Why do you say you feel it's less saturated?
I feel like right now we're a little bit more saturated because not only do we have the core titles running, you've got the two main side titles, right? The White Knight and then Busix. And then you've got the Dark Knights thing, which is multiple titles a month. And it has tie-ins that had the one-shots like the Devastator, the Merciless, the Red Death, all of those.
Yep.
There's just a lot more coming out per month. And I think that when you step back and take a look at everything that has the name Batman in the title, it's a lot more. Sure, you've got Justice League, you've got all those things that do have Batman in them, and Super Sons, but that's a little different than just a core Batman title. And you could argue that most of the books that I had mentioned, those are core Batman titles, whether it's in the main universe, in the dark multiverse, in a separated timeline, in a different part of the multiverse, still having Batman as the core title name, there's a lot of it.
Well, you said you feel that's newer. I mean, I'm 40 plus years old. I feel like between Batman, Detective, The Dark Knight, Gotham by Gaslamp, whatever the quarterly book was, Batman Family, Brave and the... I feel like my entire life there have been 4 to 5 Batman books a month. It doesn't feel like a new phenomenon.
I would agree with that, but I think, again, in my mind, the difference is even when Batman and Detective both featured Batman, one was more action, one was more detective-type stuff. You know, Brave and the Bold or Batman and the Outsiders, that was the team-up book. World's Finest or Batman Superman or whatever, that was when he's with Superman or Trinity with Wonder Woman, whatever. There was a clear difference between those books, but for the life of me, I would have a hard time really explaining what differentiates the different Avenger books or the different X-Men books or, you know, some of those other franchises that are a little too large or even really Justice League or Justice League of America, you know?
Well, and I do think that's a newer phenomenon.
But I think that lack of identity is the problem.
And I'm not complaining. I'm a huge Batman fan. I actually, on my laptop, have a Batman vinyl decal. I mean, I'm not complaining about the amount of Batman product out. I think the two key pieces are, number one, like John was saying, it's discernibly different which Batman is what and where they belong. And number two, I don't know if this is reality, but I think the perception right now from at least many of the folks that come into our store, and I'm just going to qualify to our store, I'm not going to say everyone, the perception is that the Batman products are being written and delivered at a higher quality than, say, the X Universe, the Deadpool books, things like that, which sometimes the art may not be to everybody's liking. But when you've got Sean Murphy doing art on one project, you've got Kurt Busiek writing another one, those are huge names that have a very long track record of high quality product. And so I think that there's a perception, whether it be right or wrong, that even though there's a larger amount of Batman titled product, it's of a higher quality, and therefore it's okay to buy and read, and I enjoy it.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with any of that. I just, in your very first statement when you said, Batman hasn't been, there haven't been as many Batman books for that long, I kind of went, wait a minute, how long is that long? Because, like I said, I got 40 years worth where it feels like there have been a ton.
Yeah, I think it's just now there's more in addition to that ton that there was.
Yeah.
There was always a lot, but now not only are there all those titles, there's all the other Batman family titles. Many of Batman and these other family titles are coming out twice monthly. Plus, you've got a event or two centering or heavily featuring Batman.
That is true. It's gone from 4 or 5 a month to 12 a month. That'll give you.
And that was kind of my point.
I mean, there's a ton here.
The other thing I wanted to point out when you said, you know, it's DC, Marvel, DC. Just for interest, I took Marvel and DC out of this list. There's only, and this goes back to, we always talk about how there's really the big two and why we focus on them so much and why they get talked about so much. There's only 39 issues in the top 1,000 not published by Marvel and DC. Of those, you take the 12 issues of The Walking Dead out, there's only 27, and all of them are below 250. So again, when people ask, hey, what about those indie titles? Why don't more stores order them? Why don't you buy them? Why don't more people talk about them? The truth is, people just don't buy them, or at least not in the same numbers.
Well, yeah, one thing that I did think was interesting was looking at what you had, what you said, Sam, taking Marvel and DC out. You know, obviously the top books are going to be Image predominantly. It's Walking Dead. But then you get to a grouping of Saga, and something weird happened where Saga 43 isn't on this list.
That was, I think, the promotionally priced one.
Was that the quarter issue?
I think it was.
Yeah, it was the quarter issue. That's why. Okay. So, I mean, we could assume that the sales on that were quite dramatically higher, especially in our store. But yeah, that was, I thought that was interesting how there was just a big grouping of Walking Dead, couple of Valiant, Dark Horse, and IDW, and then a big grouping of Saga, which speaks to the quality of those two products. And
well, there wasn't a big grouping of Dark Horse, IDW. There's only there's a total of 10 non-Image DC and Marvel books in the top 1,000. And again, even Saga, you mentioned Saga, and it gets talked about quite a bit. You take Walking Dead out of that list, there's a total of 27 books, none in the top 250, and that includes all the sagas.
Yep, yep.
That's part of why when I go through my articles, when I go through a lot of these episodes and stuff, I tend to focus on Marvel and DC. That's the majority of the data.
It is, yeah.
You know, it's interesting. It's fun to talk about some of the other stuff, but it's hard to build up trends on some of these because a lot of these are much shorter run titles. So by the time they've gotten enough to have an interesting, something worthy of charting, the series is over and it's moved on to something else.
Yeah. And this may be where TJ's got something to... It is a very different list when you look at the top trades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see much more of the Image factor in there. You see a lot more trades. I mean, I guess not a lot more. There's still a lot of number, you know, volume ones. But you do see a little bit more diversity for sure. And then the hard part is that with the trades, they can continue to sell, right? You just have so little sell through after the first couple of weeks on the single issue side, except for the oddities like the Doomsday Clock or the Metal that will continue to sell just because there's overall demand. It's a very different sales curve.
Absolutely. And I think part of it is on the comic side, in the top 1,000, there's only 8 publishers represented, whereas on the trade side, there's like 30.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different game on the two sides.
Not only is there 8 publishers, there, minus 3 publishers, there's only 10 books represented.
10 titles.
No, 10 items. Not even titles. 10 items. Filter out Marvel, Image, and DC. You are left with 10 items.
Yep, you are indeed correct. It's a very short list.
There's only 27 if you put Image back in and take The Walking Dead out.
Leaving Image out for a second, of those, most of them are first issues. We've got 1 second issue and 2 third issues.
Yes.
One thing I want to comment on to TJ's point where he talked about the long tail with trades and how there's a little bit more ability to sell over the long term. That is 100% true. However, there's a caveat. We don't get that opportunity with especially Marvel and sometimes DC with their books. When they're out of stock, they're out of stock. And there has to be a certain threshold level of reorder desire before they will go back to a second printing. Now, with DC, they've gone a lot better at kind of rushing back to a second print. But in the case of Marvel specifically, I think James and I commented on one of our episodes. If not, I brought it up somewhere, maybe on Drew and Kyle's podcast. But we actually have started watching items on the invoice, especially ones that we know are starting to flare up through discussion. Thanos 15 in this last week was one of those items where it got super hot and the buzz was happening right before the books were released. We went on to Diamond to see, well, okay, if we have damages, are they going to have any stock to be able to actually fill damages? And no, they were out because people had put in a bunch of reorders before the books even hit the shelves and kind of vacuumed all that up. So there's times where with Marvel and DC, we don't get that opportunity to be able to have any sort of a tail. It's just cut right off from us. Now, like I said, DC has done a little bit better job, and Marvel is starting to get better at rushing back to a second print. But with things like Image, with Valiant, Dark Horse, IDW, Boom, especially if it's an A cover, those tend to be in stock longer at Diamond, which gives us better opportunity to pull things in. So case in point, if you look at this be item or row 432, which is Saga 41. Over the course of the year, there has been almost 1,000, about 850 items reordered over the course of the year. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's 850 times a reader came in and said, can I get this issue? And a retailer was able to say, yes, I will get it for you and I will have it, you know, in 2 weeks. That goes a long way. So while the numbers may be half that of what some of the main DC or Marvel titles are, the non-big two publishers in many cases offer us a better opportunity to not necessarily max out our orders, but be able to go back and get them if we need to.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a difference between the two. It's not the same as a trade, but it's different than the big two for single issues.
And again, if TJ wants to jump in here, I do want to point out, you take Marvel and DC out of the Topps Comics list, you're left with 39 items. You take Image out, you're left with 10. You do the exact same thing on the trade list. If you take Marvel and DC out, you're left with 330 items. You take Image out, you're still left with 202 items.
Well,
so there's a lot more publishers that at least have a fighting chance in the trade game.
Well, and I think that in a lot of ways, you have a very stratified market in terms of the comic market. There are your Wednesday Warrior and your pamphlet heavy people. And then there are a lot of readers, especially the new readers over the last 5 to 10 years, especially the female readers that like, you know, an entire story, that like a concentrated amount, and that, you know, the trade format really works. Obviously, there's a certain amount of people that just read in trade, and just with the fact that you in general, especially Image is actually one of the underrated success parts of Image's success the last 5 years has been their willingness to overprint and have extra stock, and knowing that if this creator is going to be producing this book for a while, I'm going to overprint volume 1, 2, and 3 because I know that we're going to get reorder activity on it. They were forward thinking in that, and it's taken Marvel a long time to get around to, you know, Brian Hibbs for a long time has spoken about how Marvel does a print run and that's it when it comes to their trades, and then stuff is just out of stock until maybe a movie comes out 2 or 3 years later and then they'll be willing to reprint something. But Image especially has been very willing to reprint their trade paperbacks, and depending on the venue they're selling them at, there's quite a bit of the margin for the creators in terms of where the real ability to make money is. So, you know, obviously Image's focus is on passing a lot of that profit back to the creator. So it's in their best interest to be very trade reliant in terms of profitability. And you just see a lot more diversity in the trades. And, you know, the honest truth is we look at this stuff and this is direct market, but you know that Amazon is selling 10 times this in terms of a lot of the Image stuff. So there's a huge market for that too.
I know they're selling this. I don't know if they're selling 10 times this.
Oh, I guarantee you that Amazon is selling 10 times the amount of Walking Dead that the direct market is. There's just no way it's not.
Of something like Walking Dead, I would be willing to believe that. For something else, maybe not.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree with you. Okay. You're absolutely right. You know, the top five breakouts at Image, you know, Saga, Walking Dead, Paper Girls, you're going to see that. Yeah, obviously for a lot of stuff. Like Monstrous, that does very well at Amazon as well.
Well, the other thing in terms of keeping stuff in print on the trade side, I think the larger a company's library grows, the harder it is for them to keep stuff in print. They've got a lot more tough decisions to be making there.
That is true. And Marvel and DC have, you know, decades of material that they have to kind of, you know, manage.
And they're going to focus on what's selling the best. So even if there is a demand, a tangible demand, if it's not as big as some of the other stuff, it's not going to get reprinted, and the retailers will lose out on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, as long as we've got Eric here, because this is always an interesting discussion, you represent a direct market store.
Correct.
If you're willing to share, what percentage of your sales do you think are single issues to trades?
Our sales breakdown by dollars are roughly even between our total sales for single issues and our total sale for trades. And I think most retailers, if you ask them what the, I don't want to say bigger threat, what the, Amazon's not going to want to compete so much on a single issue level. Number one, again, the amount of touches per dollar is just ridiculous for a single issue, the shipping constraints, things like that. So Amazon and the sellers on Amazon are going to prefer to go with those trade paperbacks because at a at a lower margin income on a higher priced item, they still make a little bit more money. So that's where you see a lot of brick and mortar stores will have a rougher time kind of keeping up. One of the things that kind of it gets under James and I, it gets under our skin a little bit, is when someone comes in and says, do you have this trade? And we say, unfortunately, no, we don't, but we can order it and get it in and call you when it's here. And people just look at us and go, that's right, I'll just get it on Amazon then. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, that hurts. But you know, it's the way of the market. And if you, you know, if we have two people come in who have that same reaction over the same book, you can be darn sure we're going to have at least one copy of that on the shelf the next week. But if it's just a random one-off title, it's kind of that whole, there's only so much we can do and there's only so many things we can stock. So the single issues we don't feel as much of a competitive bite against Amazon's with, but definitely with the trades, that's where it tends to get you the most. And it does tend to be on things like Walking Dead, Saga, Paper Girls, some of those bigger indie titles, because that's what we tend to see. The people who either aren't dyed-in-the-wool comic readers or people who don't necessarily want to fully be into the comics world, they just want to come in for their, you know, their independent comic books, and they don't care where they get it per se. We're just down the street, so they figure they should stop in and check and see if we've got it. It doesn't really bother them to buy it somewhere else. Whereas a lot of our actual customers who are buying superhero-based trades, specifically in the Marvel and DC universe, they've been around long enough to know what the retail establishment means, and so they're less likely to say, oh, I'll just go to Amazon then. They're more built to say, oh, yeah, go ahead and order it, throw it in my box when it comes in.
When I was in San Diego before I moved around 2000, the store I'd been shopping at there, the manager was a little getting angsty about a new shopping development they were doing, because it was almost literally across the street that they were going to plant this, and have since planted what at the time was a new, is now about a 20-year-old shopping center that included a huge Barnes & Noble. So even without the Amazon threat, the big box stores like that, granted there's really, I think, only Barnes & Noble these days since Borders has gone under. How far are you from the closest one of those?
The closest Barnes & Noble is probably 20 minutes away.
All right, so not like an immediate threat, sort of a, well, I'll just go across the street and get it there kind of deal.
No, but there are four comic stores within 10 minutes, no, within 5 minutes of the two Barnes & Nobles in the Milwaukee area. But Milwaukee, Wisconsin in general, but especially Milwaukee, is a very unique market when it comes to comics. A lot of those old classics, Illustrated and things like that, were printed in Racine, which is less than an hour away from us. So there's been a comic culture here much longer. So people are generally more interested to go to a comic store. Now, that doesn't mean that people, especially like for manga, a lot of people will prefer to buy their manga through Barnes & Noble. We do have a manga section. We carry some of the main titles and a few things here and there. But by and large, most manga readers are going to end up going to Barnes & Noble because they can stock 10 bookshelves full of it.
Yeah.
But as far as the superhero comics goes, we've actually, James and I, you know, we do our shop crawls quarterly, which actually Friday we're doing another one. We do step into Barnes & Noble as well and just kind of see, like, what's their setup look like? What books are they featuring? What's the size of it? And we've actually seen their superhero section shrinking a little bit, but we've seen a very steady presence of their independent book section. Things like March, like the Raina Telgemeier books, Walking Dead, obviously, Saga, things like that. But we definitely see more of the independent niche growing or staying the same, and the superhero stuff tending to shrink a little bit here.
Interesting. You guys have anything else on the top sellers list for the year? The only other things that really were of note to me was 96% of the top 1,000 were Marvel or DC. About 60% of the items were at the $3.99 point at about... no, actually, that's sort of the full list. 47.76% of the top 1,000 were at $3.99. 30% are at $2.99, and then it was kind of scattered around after that. Shall we move on to one of the other tabs of this workbook? I've got stats for the top, not the top, but all of the titles that shipped over the year, how many units, how many items, all that kind of stuff. If there's anything anybody has to speak on that, we can go into that. Otherwise, we can move past it. Hearing nothing, we'll move past it.
I will say this. Looking at that, I do find most interesting the only regular title, or the highest selling regular title, with, you know, more than one or two items on the list, are all Batman books. Batman, as far as average units, once you take out, you know, Phoenix Resurrection, Dark Days, Dark Knight 3, Batman, 25 issues shipped, averaging 91,000 units, which is far and away the largest for any kind of ongoing book.
Just averaging that many units is phenomenal. Averaging that with 25 issues having come out in the year?
Yeah.
Insane. DC's got some strong stuff there, and they've been able to, like we've been talking about, leverage Batman without draining it dry. And I think that's pretty impressive.
Absolutely.
The next tab we've got, I don't know that we need to really talk too much about that either. That's just the compilation of the monthly comics data from the 12 months and such. Had that in there just in case we had questions or needed to jump into it. The one after that, I always find kind of fun and interesting to talk to, the top comics by month sheet. And what I've got here is basically some summary information on a month-to-month basis and a couple of small little charts here on just how are the top 300 comics doing in terms of units from month-to-month, in terms of dollars from month-to-month, and then split it out to Marvel, DC, and other. But then also chart how's the top of the list and how's the bottom of the list kind of trending. And it was kind of a downward year. There were some definite ups and stuff. I think May and June were strong months. But you look at the last half, and it goes up, but then in that last quarter, it's not doing so well. We ended the year about 1 million units lower than we started the year, with, you know, a few places again, the May, June, doing above the 7,000-ish, or 7 million-ish we started with. Marvel started the year, kind of went down, then went up, then went down, then went up a little, and then kind of trailed off a little. Whereas DC had a rough first half of the year, a strongish third quarter, but then a really not so good December. Whereas the other publishers in aggregate, not so good January, February, but most of the rest of the year, pretty even keel. It trended down a little, but given the diversity of material, the number of publishers and stuff like that, nothing that makes me think, wow, there's a problem there.
Yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of reflection in the trends of events, especially with Marvel. You had Secret Empire that boosted things, and then it dipped. And then you had Legacy, which kind of may have boosted things, and then it's slowly starting to tail off. So I think those trends are to be expected when you're doing so many event books. And obviously with DC, you had the Justice League Suicide Squad event that kind of happened. And then now you're still into Dark Knights, but you had a big flare-up of Dark Knights where you had all those single one-off issues. You had some of the tie-in issues. So you had a lot of that. Now you have Doomsday Clock, of course, which you'd expect to see the numbers being bounced a little higher. But again, when you've got, you know, 4 to 5 issues of an event book happening in a month, like we did with some of the Dark Knights stuff, that definitely, or the metal stuff, I should say, that definitely plays into it. So for me, I'm not shocked to see or hear the trends, because I think that that maps pretty well to what the publishers, of, especially the big two, are doing.
Well, and also, I think with Marvel, the Legacy Initiative, where you had a lot of new volumes all coming out at once that were heavily promoted, followed by issues that were not heavily promoted, and therefore you had the downward trend there.
Yep, absolutely.
Looking at the chart of the ceiling and the floor is where basically rank 300 is, and the ceiling is that top item. We had a few months where we had some really strong sellers, particularly September there with the 300,000 for the ceiling. Others where there were really the first quarter, not much was that much above the 100,000 mark. So this is ended the year and gone through most of the year much better than the first quarter. And the floor is really interesting because, and it may just be that I don't have this necessarily cutting off at the right point, because that floor of 580 for December seems really kind of anomalous.
Yeah, didn't you build out past 300 or 500 with some of the smaller and indie publisher books? That might be factoring
to
into
be,
it.
To be fair, in December we got 500 for no explicable reason.
Right? I think it's factoring in the 500, not the 300. I didn't have
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's one of the changes from previous years, where I think the last time I ran this, we didn't have anything over 300 to really be truncating against. So, yep, that's that. So, disregard that fall off on the floor on that December. There have been some years where there's some really sharp peaks and valleys here. There's just, I think, the normal fluctuation based on, like you were saying, what events, what's being published, and what's going on. There have been a couple of times, like when we had the launch of the New 52 or initiatives like that, where you would just see one month where it's like, man, this thing spiked, and then it went back down or wherever.
Right.
The next tab we've got is what I call the Comics Advances and Declines, and it's kind of the, I don't say the stock market look at it, but what's going up, what's going down. And really, I don't think there's anything too surprising here in terms of there's usually way more declines than there are advances, and the net on that basis is usually almost always negative, sometimes to the factor of like a million units or something. This is different than the month-to-month look I've been doing with Sam over the last year or two, where that's doing literally a month-to-month. This is doing issue-to-issue advances and declines. And it paints a very different picture in so much as we now have multiple issues coming out in a given month, whereas at one point we didn't. And some titles just go away for quite some time and then pop back. Really, the big takeaway is there were a lot more declines in December. Part of that is more items on the list, and again, part of that is also just some of the sharp drops we've been seeing on subsequent legacy issues after the first. I've got two quick charts I tossed together here on the units by month and the dollars by month, which I just have because, well, I'd built them at one point and I saw no reason to get rid of them. By and large, Marvel and DC started the year out neck and neck for most of the first quarter. Unsurprisingly, Marvel was pulling ahead for most of the rest of the year, but in November and December, DC's been ahead. Historically, 9 out of 10 months, Marvel is going to be ahead on this trade on this list, whereas on the trade list, it's like a 1 in 3 kind of a deal for DC versus Marvel, in Marvel's favor usually, I believe. And you can also see just kind of how the total units for the top 300 are trending, whereas really I don't think we ever got above about 7.25 million units this year, whereas last year I think it was around the September-ish time frame we were at like 9.5 million. So it's a little disconcerting to see the drop over the last quarter of the year, particularly whereas a year before, you know, things were really strong, and we're going into a first quarter and that's usually not a strong point. But again, like Eric was saying, it's a reflection of as much what events, what's being published, and things of that nature.
Well, and I think you can, what you can glean from these charts is you can kind of see maybe why some of the leadership changes were made at Marvel. You know, that seems to be a business that is very, you know, revenue and certain sales level requirements. And if you miss those enough quarters, they're going to make a change. And they did make a change. So obviously, sometimes when you look at these charts, you don't see as big a deltas as you would expect to see when you have leadership change. But, you know, at the big companies, it's kind of like that's how they make their decisions. So it'll be interesting to see this coming year if the new the new guy can make any sort of headway, or if Marvel's decisions and the things they do lock them into kind of this spiral. We'll see.
Would it be a fair statement to say that when sales are not going particularly great over at Marvel, they change leadership or change the players involved? Whereas over at DC, when things aren't going well, and I'm thinking specifically early 2011, they change what they do, not necessarily the players involved.
I mean, that's a question I haven't been, you know, I've only been back on the scene for like maybe 3 years now. So it's hard for me to say because there was such a long period when I was away. I definitely think that DC gives their leadership a little bit longer leash, but, you know, at the end of the day, they're still, you know, a profit-making business, so they still have to hit their numbers in a certain respect. But, yeah, I mean, in general, you just see Marvel is, they do more things that you can tell are just numbers-based.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of a tough thing to dispute or discuss, because you think about just the way that DC and Marvel have run their business over the last decade. You know, Marvel still holds tight to the claim that they've never relaunched or rebooted their universe. I guess rebooted their universe is the best way to say it. Whereas DC has theoretically done it twice. And I don't know if part of that is you have to work within the confines at Marvel, whereas at DC they get a little more leeway. I don't know. I can speak as a retailer that from a publisher standpoint, DC does, I should say this, when James and I took over the store 3 years ago, DC was definitely all hands on deck listening and wanting to make changes. And a lot of the things that retailers have asked for and continue to ask for, DC changes and does. Marvel wasn't quite as willing originally to do that, but over the last, I'm going to say 12 months, they have done a 180. And they've listened to retailers, they have taken what we've said to heart, and they've made some changes from just their publishing practices and how they interact with us that have been beneficial. There's still a long way to go in every retailer's mind. You could pick up, you know, a dozen different things for any given publisher. It's tough to say. I don't know. And I definitely feel like Marvel has had some very long tenured leadership. So I don't know if that's the thing, because I look at DC and I see the promotion of Geoff Johns, right? So he really escalated his role over the last year and a half to 2 years. I'm not even talking about the film franchises. I'm just talking about going from kind of a senior staff writer to essentially creative director for how a lot of the main sections of the DC superhero universe are tying their stories together. So there's been some alterations with staff internally. There's been some editorial changes at DC. So I feel like that the movement is kind of equal between the publishers. It's just where you see it and how you feel it. And sometimes it's more retailer based. Sometimes it's more publishing, I should say, more creative based. So I don't know. I kind of feel like they're more even than anything after I said all of that.
It just feels historically that there seems to be either more turnover or more noticeable or more dramatic turnover at the top over at Marvel than at DC.
Definitely more dramatic turnover. That I will 100% agree with.
I don't know. It's just the culture of the two companies from the outside seems very different. Obviously, I haven't worked at either, so I don't know the inside scoop on that. It just seems like when things aren't going well, you know, for Marvel, you're going to see an announcement of so-and-so's replacing so-and-so, whereas, you know, when things weren't going well, the existing leadership announced the new 52 or announced Rebirth or something like that over at DC.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I haven't been able yet to go to Marvel to see and kind of experience their environment. I've been able to experience DC's environment in Burbank, and if I was offered a job, I'd be hard pressed to say no. It was a very wonderful environment to be around, and nice people all over the place to talk to. So, I would be very interested to go into the Marvel environment and just see what that's like as well to compare it.
Cool. We recorded all of this in one sitting, but it was getting to be a really long episode. So I'm going to break it here. We'll pick up on the next episode going over the trade stuff with the same gang of Sam, TJ, Eric, and myself. So please join us for that. It's a lot of fun. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themayoreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future.
No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions. They're not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists. Either included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.